Okay, hello there, everyone. Welcome to Open Source's Guelph. You're on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico, and joining me is...
Scotty Hertz of the CFRU News Team. Adam, speaking of news, have you got your Eclipse glasses? Are you ready to rock for that thing, or...?
No, I think I've scheduled something for when it starts, so I don't know if I'll be... I mean, I have a pair of Eclipse glasses somewhere around here that I can slip on and go outside and watch if I'm really, really interested, but I mean, I've seen one solar eclipse in the last couple of years, so...
But you're prepared, though. Just don't mix them up with your 3D glasses from the movies, right?
Oh my goodness, that's, yeah... That might actually happen.
Somebody's gonna do it. Or you can just be like Trump and just look at the thing. Burn a hole in the brain.
It's interesting this is coming up. I had a nice long conversation with Santana from Guelph today about this morning, about the nature of the human eyeball and how it's dangerous to look at eclipses and why that is. So it's been an eclipsey. It's been an eclipsey day for sure. All right. Open Source is a CFRU's political and current affairs discussion show, and you can find us here every Thursday at 5 p.m. as we talk about the latest news items from Guelph, Ontario, Canada, and around the world. And we sometimes interview local newsmakers and politicians. This week, though, it's just the news, including the Sunshine List. We will talk about whether or not our politicians and high-ranking public officials are living too large, or maybe why we care so much about it. But then, only you can prevent forest fires, but only the provincial government is responsible for fighting them, and we will see how Ontario is doing on that account. Hint, it is not good. And finally, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., he will be the name we will all curse when Trump wins re-election, unless, of course, Trump doesn't win re-election, and in which case he'll be an interesting footnote. He'll be a Trivial Pursuit answer to a question in Trivial Pursuit, but we'll see about that. But first, happy 75th year in Confederation to our friends down in Newfoundland and Labrador. I guess it was just technically before midnight on March the 31st, 1949, that Newfoundland and Labrador officially became the 10th and so far final province in Canada. And it's interesting to note that, I mean, in the midst of, you know, commemorative license plates and special scholarships and, you know, Premier Fury putting up the union letters outside his office and in several very nice frames, there's still a lot of, I don't know if you want to call them hurt feelings, considering not many people who voted in that referendum are probably still alive, but... it's interesting to note that Newfoundland and Labrador joining Confederation was not a slam dunk in 1948 when they had the second of two referendums. They did it kind of, I guess, ranked ballot style, where there were three options: joining Confederation, responsible government, or forming a governing council. The third option, which was the governing council, fell off. That left responsible government and Confederation. Confederation won with about 52.3%. So it's interesting to note that Newfoundland and Labrador were coming into Confederation was not like a supermajority affair. And 75 years later, it's still an interesting question about just how committed your average Newfoundlander, or Newfie, if you will, was committed to the Canadian project.
I guess we're still allowed to say Newfie, eh? Because every Newfoundlander, yeah. Labradorian I know uses it as shorthand.
Yeah, I wasn't sure myself. You're right.
I guess if we get some mail, we get some letters from Cornerbrook, we'll know that we probably shouldn't have, but it's meant with the best of intentions.
For sure.
Our friends to the east who may be listening, I think we do have one. At one point, we had a listener out there. So if you're still listening, let us know whether that's kosher now or not anymore. Yeah, an interesting story. And as you said, like there's an air of conspiracy theory to this. And a lot of the old timers and some of the young timers, too, feel that it was a bit of a shady deal because no one ever saw the results. Like there was no it was governed by Britain, by the UK, who were effectively overseeing Newfoundland from the Depression years, right? There was, Newfoundland was so broke because of the Depression and other factors that there was pretty much a committee established to run Newfoundland from the UK.
Mm-hmm.
And that ran until they joined Confederation in 1949. So they've had some strange arrangements. I think a lot of people feel that Newfoundland was its own country up until that point. And technically it was at one point. So it does have this long history. It didn't just start in 1949. There's this long lead up to it, but it's been said because Britain was broke because of the war,
mm-hmm.
that the referendum was kind of tailored to, this is the result we want, because it got to the point Newfoundland was so strong during the Second World War that they were loaning money to Britain. So they had gone from being essentially bailed out mm-hmm. by the old country as a dominion to being to funding to helping out the European cousins, are actually the parent country at that point up until 49.
Mm-hmm.
But there's been lasting, I guess, deep effects from that. One of them was during World War II, when Newfoundland became a bit of a hub of operations for flights to Europe during the war. Gander mm-hmm. is still there, and even though it wasn't in huge use, or is not extensively used anymore, certain people refuel there. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of the jet setters, like maybe Musk, etc. But of course, as we know, in 9/11, it became the hub, and once again brought to the fore because of what happened, the whole come from away story. The links are deep there. It was a huge American presence during the war, and that bumped up Newfoundland once again. And it's surprising because you mentioned the three options. If I understand it right, the third option was a party that was suggesting closer ties with the U.S. And at that point in the 40s, USA wasn't interested in having close ties to Newfoundland, but I guess then they didn't know. It didn't come later until later that there was oil present.
Mm-hmm.
So had they known that, maybe things might have been a little bit different. But
yeah, a lot of that conspiracy stuff you're talking about, it seems to come from like that sort of one singular book, this Gary Malone book, Don't Tell the Newfoundlanders, which came out about 10 years ago, that this is kind of a... it's a deep government conspiracy that, you know, Mackenzie King wanted to complete the original vision of Canada, which was like coast to coast to coast. And Newfoundland was kind of the missing piece of that. So it served that purpose. Newfoundland becoming a part of Canada meant wiping out Britain's debt, as you mentioned. And the United States, I think, you know, in the case of the U.S., because of Newfoundland's unique position, sort of jutting out there at the eastern end of North America, it just, you know, makes for a convenient location for ports and airstrips, you know, in a time when, you know, cross globe flights were kind of, let's say, fuel intensive. Mm-hmm. so, I mean, that was kind of convenient. And you know, from what I gather from the book, you know, Malone is like, well, the U.S. basically didn't care as long as they could still have like a presence there. And, you know, they're not being, you know, because it was the Cold War, 49 was the year NATO was incorporated. So as long as, you know, the U.S. agenda wasn't impacted, you know, they were fine either way. So it is interesting. And I watched a global piece, and the woman who was in charge of like the museum exhibit, the room, which is about the referendum, she said, you know, people used to say, you know, who voted to join Canada? All the people in the graveyard. So, I mean, even at the time, there's like this conspiracy of it that sounds oddly prescient. This like, oh, it was like the dead people on the voter roll. Voted to join Canada, which is so bizarre. But you know, it's a reminder that, you know, conspiracy theories aren't necessarily a new idea. It's there beneath the surface. And you know, when you are a population like Newfoundland, who because of World War One debt, because of the Great Depression, were had their government essentially taken away from them, having their autonomy taken away from them in a very real extent, and then being able to bounce back and being this important port of call during the war and becoming this little power on the eastern coast, you know, it does make a lot of sense that people might feel that something was taken from them, an opportunity was taken. But along with that, I did find an article from this Indigenous activist, Kelvin White, who noted that, you know, in the union letters, there's nothing in there about the Mi'kmaq or any First Nations groups in Newfoundland and Labrador, of whom there are many. They were largely left out of this. You know, another example, sort of colonialism. Interesting to note, too, that Newfoundland, home to North America's longest or oldest colonial settlement, the Viking settlement at Las Omeras. No. So it's, you know, there's a lot going on with this that still hasn't been completely worked out, even if we just leave aside the conspiracy theories.
I'm glad you mentioned colonialism, because that's normally me, but it is part of Newfoundland in its form is there because of the colonial project.
Mm-hmm.
No argument there, and maybe from the Vikings on, but of course, there's the extinction of the Beothuk people. Right. That's always just kind of a footnote, but it's like settlers came and then they were gone and other peoples displaced as well. It still hasn't been completely addressed.
Mm.
Are they working on that? Yes, of course they should be. But this is still it's a place of what's the population? 500,000. So it's something like Kitchener. So the logic would suggest even back in the day that they should just join Canada. But it's funny hearing that term responsible government, because that's essentially the relationship that we have or had with Britain.
Mm.
So to have to duplicate all of that, and considering your size, no, I guess there are places that do. There's still lots of British protectorates out there that are small and have some resemblance of self-government. They're getting less and less, obviously, but it's... they probably chose correctly. I think it's. I remember hearing Malone or seeing Greg Malone talking about it, same kind of thing. It was just like, well, you know, we probably made the best decision, even though it seemed kind of sketch, and that may be the conclusion. But Greg Malone, also a comedian, I'm not sure if he's still. I was going to say a practicing comedian. They're not practicing, but it was CODCO, right? Like,
yeah.
Again, this is. The presence of Newfoundland and Labrador has enriched Canada to no end with people like Malone, CODCO, 22 Minutes, Mercer, who came from 22 Minutes, but also Mark Critch, among others, right? Mm-hmm. So is Canada the better, for, at least in the arts, for having the presence of Newfoundland and Labrador? Of course we are. Because who's done more for Canada than highlighting and, you know, taking other Canadians across the country to see what it's all about? It's Rick Mercer.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, you know, they are definitely an important piece of this colonial project we call Canada. So,
yeah, it's you know, the occasion of this 75th anniversary is also a reminder. I think, you know, joking about calling people from Newfoundland Newfie and that kind of thing, it's kind of a reminder that we've long kind of made Newfoundlanders the butt of our jokes. I mean, we essentially treat Newfoundland at times the way people in the United States treat Alabama or Mississippi. It's like this backwards area, this vestige of like backwardsness and uneducation and I don't know what else, you know, people living in the past and all this stuff. And that's just, you know, when you start digging into the history of Newfoundland, like I've been doing this week, that's just like kind of not the case. That's actually a very, I was going to say it's a small part of the story. I don't think it's even a small part of the story at all. I think we get very focused on sort of what we remember from our own history in the late 80s, early 90s, which was like when the fishery industry kind of went bust and, you know, thinking about Danny Williams taking down the Canadian flag, you know, sitting there at a press conference going, we're going to get rid of that flag, get rid of that flag. And, you know, that's the kind of silliness.
Yell at Paul McCartney. Yeah.
Yeah. and all of that. And I think it belies a sort of like rich sort of independent streak of this area of this area of the country. And like conspiracy aside, I think you're right that there was a call that had to be made. I think Joey Smallwood and other people were definitely thinking about the future. It's like good times don't last, good planning does. And doesn't it make more sense to be a part of this larger project called Canada as opposed to thinking, you know, certain other provinces could maybe learn this lesson in the modern day that good times don't last. And you have to make plans for the future because what happens when opportunity runs out and wells run dry, as it were. So, there's a lot to be learned from, I think, from Newfoundland. And I'm glad that we got this chance to remember that on this anniversary.
Yeah, no one said Newfoundland, Labrador, quite like the premier. It was like almost a catchphrase. I don't think Fury does the same, but Newfoundland, Labrador. It was always a very assertive Newfoundland, Labrador, asserting the rights.
Yeah, I mean, there's something about Fury. He's such a little prep school weasel looking guy, but maybe that's just me.
But liberal, they're still electing liberals out that way, right? So.
Well, true enough.
As Smallwood was. So.
For now. All right. speaking of Scotty's favorite beats, we're going to talk about the Sunshine List. And no, talking about this was not just a way to wind up Scotty, just so everyone knows. it is interesting to note. We have this sort of weird confluence of things. The MP pay raise went into effect this week. From what I gather, Canada now has the second most well-paid federal government representatives in the world, so that's not too shabby. Justin Trudeau's take-home is $406,200. That's not too shabby. If you're a government minister, you get $299,900, and that's the same as the leader of the official opposition gets. Of course, at the end of March is the annual release of the Public Sector Salary Disclosure, a.k.a. the Sunshine List. And so it seems like an interesting opportunity because, I'm sure I'm winding up Scotty as I speak. there is an affordability crisis right now. Obviously, when you hear politicians and like public sector workers get pay raises, that's obviously a pressure point. That's the red meat that groups like the Canadian Taxpayers Federation feed on. I think it's an interesting point though to raise the question like. Is it wrong to pay our politicians well? And is, you know, every industry has its bad apple, shall we say? But, you know, if you want to attract the best, perhaps we should pay you like you're the best. I don't know. I'm going to just step back from the microphone and let Scotty cook now.
I'm going to promise to give a measured response on this. I've given a lot of thought because every time we talk about it, right, I manage to get wound up. And I don't know if it's your lead-in is what gets me wound up or I'm just naturally wound up. But anyway, deep breath, right? So let's focus on the Canadian Taxpayers Federation for a second, who are always the people that give out the prepared information on this every single time. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter. They will say, oh, you know, considering that for years and years, even pre-internet, they have been around to announce this.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I haven't heard any of the performative stuff from the Conservatives. It used to be Reform. We're like, we're not going to take the pension. Preston Manning's not going to live in Stornoway. They used to do this kind of stuff. And I think it bought them some interest. Mm-hmm. No complaints from Poilievre on this. If he said anything about it, I didn't hear a single thing about it because I think he feels that he earns his $300,000. And Trudeau, same with, well, and they're both millionaires, you know, yeah, or any Mulroney. You name any level of government, you name it. It's like there are a lot of wealthy individuals who get the X amount of dollars, but they're doing the job. And, you know, you're running a whole country. Maybe I'm not really caving on this, but I'm just saying it's like you need to remunerate people properly. But I think it should be extended to everyone because they base this on. You know, this is what they're paying in industry, and it kind of happens automatically in Ottawa, and they'll be like, well, okay, we should be paying them this, and then they just get it. It's like, why isn't that extended to any fast food worker, minimum wage worker, Loblaw worker?
Mm.
Could pay people at Loblaws a lot more, and The Westons would still be billionaires, but they don't do it. Canadian Taxpayers Federation are number one for what? Fighting raises in the minimum wage. They'll put out a press release when the minimum wage goes up and they'll say, business can't afford this. How dare you? So that's where they're coming from. I guess they just have to complain about every raise across Canada, whether it's people in parliament, and they're not all millionaires, mind you, but still.
Yeah.
If you're if you're traveling from Vancouver to Ottawa for X number of whatever, I know there's subsidies in that, but you should probably be paid a decent enough wage, right? But it's like, I want everyone to get beyond the minimum wage. Like, what's it going up to in Ontario? 17.20 in the fall, right?
That should I think it went up. Did it not go up this week too? Or is it going up? Yes. Okay.
But I want that extended to everyone.
No, like, no, for
$20
sure.
Yeah. Minimum, just to entry level stuff. And then that should go up, but it's never happening. So.
No, it's funny you should say that, because as like I've been like sorting through like personal papers the last couple of weeks, and I found it wasn't a contract, because I didn't sign a contract with Zellers, but my first part-time job in high school was at Zellers, and minimum wage was $7.67. Yeah, so I mean, times have changed. Times get more expensive, and the thing with you're right. It's interesting, like just the radio silence from even conservative politicians. Because what was the other piece of news this week is that, according to the Sunshine List, like 40, I wrote the number down here somewhere, 48 people in the premier's office make over $100,000, which is compared to like 18 people in Kathleen Wynne's office in her last year as premier. Which, I mean, maybe she was like slimming down because, you know, she knew the end was nigh, and maybe she didn't need the staff to make the long-term plans, but like 48 versus 18 in 5 years. Like, the premier's office had 20 people in 2019, which was the public disclosure after the Tories took office. But, you know, he's added like 150% more people in 5 years. And again, like, I don't want to get into like how much people get paid either, especially when, you know, you go to the inflation calculator, and $100,000 in 1996, which was the red line as the legislation established in 1996, $100,000 in 2024 money, that's just over $180,000. Interestingly, because when you go to the Bank of Canada inflation calculator, it defaults to 1914, which I guess is the last like year you have records. So I just for kicks, I put in once $100,000 in 1914 compared to 2024, and it's 2.6 million and change.
Billion. Yeah.
So it's kind of interesting. But, you know, to put that in sort of like, you know, where we are today, because I covered the Guelph Police Board meetings, which means I read that that agenda. And there was a report last month's meeting about public disclosure about Guelph police salaries. And you look at it, it's like 211 people at the Guelph Police Service make over $100,000. And you're like, yeah, I know there's a lot of people in our audience are probably listening to that, like setting their hair on fire, metaphorically speaking, about that. But, you know, apply the inflation calculator. It's only about 11 positions that are in the quote-unquote sunshine position adjusted for inflation. And I do, you know, I saw a bunch of headlines, like, number of sunshine listers has gone up this year. And I'm like, of course it's going up. Of course it's going up, because people work in government positions, like in the civil service side, for years, because it's good work. You get good representation. It's usually a union position, unless you're in management. So of course your salary is going to go up. And I think this is to get back to your point. It's like, this is the ultimate thing about this, is that we do have two standards of work. You know, you get kind of good coverage working for the government, little bit less depending on where you are in the private sector. And should we not be demanding the public sector standards applying to private sector instead of ginning up people in the private sector to attack people who do work in the public sector for having the audacity to be paid well. Well, I think that's the way to look at this.
I think there is something to the argument about inflation, and it's a good one because I'm of an age now where everybody that I know that ended up a teacher that stuck with it has just recently squeaked on to the sunshine list.
Mm.
And so the argument will be, look at how many teachers are on the sunshine list. Look at how, like, but drawing from that, I think there's more to divine from the list than just who is on it and who isn't, because new teachers are essentially, by the sounds of it, from people I've been talking to, are effectively gig workers. So there's this whole block of people that have no hope ever from being a teacher in Ontario of getting on that list. They're unaccounted for. It would almost be interesting if they published a list of, here are all of the jobs within this sphere. And a good example too, going back to Guelph police, because I always look at the police on the list, and some of that is for money, but some of it is just to see how much police are going on. And I checked out Peel because I used to live in Peel, and Peel is always large.
Yeah.
On the sunshine list, there are 80 pages of police. 80 pages of the sunshine list are police in Peel region. So, and that's a lot. And going back to Guelph too, like when you were saying about, you know, there's a lot of people that are on it now that weren't before. I noticed there's 11 staff sergeants. I remember Chief Kobe came to the Breezy Breakfast and was talking about how there's only like one, there's only one patrol car doing traffic on at any given time in Guelph. And I was like, I find that really hard to believe that there's just one unit, one police car taking care of traffic for 130,000 people on any given day. Whereas there's 11 staff sergeants who are in charge of scheduling and those kinds of things. That's what staff sergeants do. So here's me trying to divine a little bit from it. It's like, where you want accountability for stuff, but when you see these just blocks of, remember they always used to complain about, oh my God, there's a plumber on the that works for the TTC and he's on the sunshine list. Now that was a few years ago. When 100, you know, and the guy, it turned out the guy worked 7 days a week, took all of the overtime. He had no life. And that's how you ended up on the sunshine list then. But now it's like there's this new, I'll call them a slate or whatever, people on it. But yeah, I think it would be far more interesting if we could get maybe these things are available, but I bet, and I'm sure you've maybe done a bit of it, that you have to dig for it. That you have to, it'd be a real pain in the ass to try and find out like every single position at the Guelph Police Service or every position, even among, you know, educators. Somebody draw me the Venn diagram or whatever of like, who is involved with this?
Well, it's a massive spreadsheet. Like if you go and, you know, when you find it, it's a massive spreadsheet with every, like, and if you want to search by like Guelph or Wellington or the Guelph Police or the Guelph Library or the hospital or the U of G or whatever, you can do that. But I mean, it's one like massive document, which also speaks to just sort of like, you know, it's like an info dump. And then, you know, most outlets just go, okay, well, who made the most in, as you said, Peel, or who made the most in Guelph, or who is the top earner in the province? By the way, the top five guys are all at Ontario Power Generation, which I find interesting. But but yeah, there's a couple of things going on. One is that, you know, the fact that $100,000 doesn't go as far as it used to. And the other is just like, it's just a giant info dump that really doesn't offer anything in the way of analysis or context or insight in terms of who these people are, what the positions are. Because you're right, you know, some of these people end up on the list because of their own, because it's not just base salary, it's benefits, it's overtime. And, I don't think, if we're judging whether we're getting value for dollar, thank you, return on investment, whatever you want to call it, I don't think just like a spreadsheet really says it. But I mean, it checks a box on transparency. And as we're going to hear and get into in our next topic, what we do really need more transparency than just a spreadsheet at times. Anyway, we'll leave that there and take a quick break and then come right back with firefighting and people setting fires, even if they're not literal. But we'll get more into that in a sec. You are listening to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
Most towns stand empty, old nets hung to dry, are blown away, lost, and forgotten.
So even though he's been gone over 40 years, Stan Rogers has a new box set, mostly live and rarity songs, but he's a good default if you need a song about, oh, I don't know, fishing in Newfoundland, perhaps.
Mm.
So I think some of our regular listeners will know that was indeed Stan Rogers. The box set's called Songs of a Lifetime, also available on vinyl, by the way. This is new, into the station. And the song was Make and Break Harbor.
Okay. Kind of glad it wasn't the Laura Trump single.
Next time.
You've heard of Auto-Tune? This is Auto-Tune Out.
Oh, I'm excited by that. Yeah.
All right. We'll get to crazy people in the United States in a minute. First, serious talk. Forest fire season started on Monday. Technically, April 1st marks this official start of forest fire season. If there aren't any actual forest fires yet, this is deeply concerning for people who may remember last summer and the smell of burning wood in downtown Guelph in the middle of June. It wasn't even technically summer yet. When we were sort of getting the worst of that with the air quality warnings and the orange sky and the smell of burning, even this far south, and if not further south, you think it might have prompted the provincial government to make some substantive changes to the way we fight forest fires, or to even make sure that they are funded properly through the budget and not through a contingency reserve. But you would be incorrect. And there's kind of a growing, as it is now, as I said, officially forest fire season, a growing sense of concern. And even the forest fighters, forest firefighters themselves are saying that they are hoping that the last couple of days with their cold and wetness is a sign of what spring's going to look like, because even after last summer, they're still really unprepared for what might be coming down the pipe.
Oh yeah, no snow, no snowpack. You have to pray for a wet spring, and it may be the only thing that saves it, and even that might not be enough. Yeah, it sounds like it's a tale of two wildfire preparation plans, right? Government does their press release this week. Hey, we're ready. We're spending more money. And then National Observer reports almost the exact opposite. The budget for 21-22 was $237 million. The budget for 23-24, the upcoming season, and some of it hasn't been spent yet, or is going to be spent soon, $135 million. So there's a $100 million gap there between the previous plan and the new plan. Mm-hmm. And part of the problem, too, as you said about spending from a reserve or the emergency fund, if you decide it's like, oh, things are out of control, we need more people, you get contractors in, it's difficult to get equipment in a hurry. Everything is going to cost more. That's just how it works when you don't have a contingency and are prepared.
Mm-hmm.
Even though we know that last year was, I don't know if it was the worst, but one of the worst, right? With the, what was it, 700 fires? I know it's three times greater than the benchmark, whatever the number was.
Yeah.
And as you mentioned too, like the there's a shortage in getting people to do this job. Mm-hmm. And that was part of the release, was they were going to give, I think it's like a $5,000 incentive to get and train people to do the work.
Yeah.
But because they're so strained and stressed, not just physically, but it's let's call it a health and safety nightmare, for lack of a better word, because you're fighting fires and it's not as if you can just run away. Mm-hmm. There's very, you've probably seen it on the news, very little protections for them. There's like, okay, well, the wind's blowing that way, so you don't really need a mask even. Like, it's rough. It's really mm-hmm. rough. And you have to be mm-hmm. a certain type to be able to do it. Mm-hmm. But even the people that have been doing it, you know, for years and years, a lot of them are retiring early, and there's the retention is difficult. So there's that too. There's the shortcoming there as well. I mean, you can throw $5,000, you can throw however much you want at that. But as we know now, like it can be difficult to get people to do lots of things, but particularly something like this where there's huge risk and the payout might not be as good as it could be.
Yeah, that whole thing with the $5,000, you know, I mean, where have we heard that before, right? I mean, that was the same thing that they used to try with nurses at the height of the pandemic. And the only visual I get from that is that scene in Good Will Hunting where Ben Affleck's sitting there at like the job interview yelling retainer. And you can find anyone who will sign on the dotted line for $5,000. Like, you can find a body that way. But what you're not going to get out of that is experience. What you're not going to get out of that is like training. And that's another piece of this that's missing too. And Noah Friedman, who is the vice president of the OPSU union that represents the firefighters, he's like, you know, we're going through people. It's not just that we need people. We're just going through them. The turnover is so high. And when people go out the door, they are taking their experience with them. And as you said, like the fire season was so brutal last year. And one of the reasons why it was, you know, especially brutal, what was the number of hectares burned? 441,000 hectares. That's mm-hmm. not small potatoes. But, you know, people, you know, so many people are taking their experience with them. And that's, can make the difference between life and death. And it's not just the money thing, as you said. It's about like the toxins, it's about smoke inhalation, it's about occurrences of cancer and heart disease. And wouldn't you also know, these particular forest fires working in the north, those injuries are not automatically covered under WSIB. So you're saying, here's $5,000, go and do this hard job 16 hours a day, 7 days a week, 8 months a year. We're going to give you $5,000, but you're going to have difficulty getting your workers' comp claim. And you're going to be taking orders from somebody who has like one extra summer of experience from you. And, you know, maybe you're not going to even do it right. And we don't even know. We're not even treating this as a real thing because it's not even officially part of the budget. And as you said, like equipment concerns. And, you know, meanwhile, I guess you got $5,000 extra in your pocket, which probably isn't going to mean much when it's September and you're fighting the same fire you were fighting in June.
Yeah. And last year, they pretty much mutinied in the woods, right? Let's call it an unofficial work to rule. And it's fully understandable considering what they had been going through. Mm-hmm. All that talk that we used to hear at early COVID period and still there was like, well, they're essential and they're critical and we love you, but I mean, mm-hmm. they don't treat you like you're loved. But the logic would be too, is that if there's better staffing, which there wasn't, then less hectares would burn. And they always do this thing saying, and Danielle Smith famously with the, well, most of the fires, it's not most, it's 50% of the fires are caused by humans.
Mm-hmm.
So by extension, couldn't it be that if we had more humans fighting the fires, then there would be less? And that's not to diminish what's been going on with climate change and lack of moisture and all those things, because it all, you know, precipitates what's going on. But I'm cynical enough to believe, and this may be a bit of a wild card thing, the mm-hmm. North is mostly NDP ridings. Is True. It not possible that the Doug Ford government are just downplaying all this because of the North is orange? Am I wrong in thinking that it is entirely possible that that's what's going on. It's like, well, you know, it's out of sight and out of mind until the cloud comes, right? Until as it did last year. And probably by the sounds of it, actual scientists saying that it will probably happen again this year and try and get people to wear a mask. Oh, good luck with that. You probably should, you know, for your own good, wear a mask, but.
You know, I would believe it, the purely cynical argument, but like Graydon Smith, who's the Minister of Natural Resources, is his riding is Parry Sound Muskoka, where there was like a particularly brutal fire in 2018, which is what one of those fires that prompted one of these many reports that's, you know, was saying that, you know, the Forest Firefighter Service was wholly unprepared for or underprepared for just how bad things can get. Now, part of the problem is that Doug Ford is completely ignoring the climate crisis.
Oh, yeah.
You know, he's screaming at the top of his lungs about the carbon tax while slashing the gas tax on automobiles, which does effectively cancels out the carbon tax and getting people to make the shift. The other thing, too, is his... I mean, it's just short-sightedness, and this is, I think, is a feature of Doug Ford, because he's uncurious and has been privileged his whole life, and, you know, we throw around ignorant a lot as a sort of pejorative. I don't necessarily mean it as a pejorative here. I think he is ignorant, but I also think he just doesn't care enough to be curious enough to find out about things that he may not understand. And I think this is one of them. And one of the things in that National Observer article you mentioned is the peat in Northern Ontario, which is a huge carbon sink. Mm-hmm. And if that ends up on fire, that is a big effing problem for everyone. Not the least of which is Doug Ford, because his Ring of Fire dreams will take a serious hit, because where is all that peat? It is on the road to the Ring of Fire. Mm-hmm. So, you know, his own short-sightedness might get him. And, unfortunately, it might be that. Unfortunately, sometimes for people like Doug Ford, the worst has to happen. And again, that's something else we saw during the pandemic. How many times were, like, public health officials, like, screaming at the provincial government to do something, and then finally on Friday at 3 p.m. you'd have a press conference. Guess what, everyone? That stuff you've been screaming at me for 3 weeks, I'm finally doing it. Round of applause. And I mean, the question will be whether or not it's too late, unfortunately.
Well, that's the thing. No plan, no future, all the whining. The default is to corporate. Like, if he felt that the peat burning up there would expose the Ring of Fire quicker, he would probably be for it. He would say, well, that's great. It's all cleared. Then we can go and dig it up. That's the mindset. That's the attitude. It was 1 billion tons of CO2 released from fires alone in Canada, Canada-wide last year, 1 billion tons.
Mm.
And that just snowballs. Sorry, that's probably an unfortunate choice because we didn't have
it.
But you know what I mean. It compounds the problem. And Ford doesn't care because there's no revenue to be made from it. I'm going to say pulp and paper isn't what it was, but it's just not, it's obviously still there, but it's just, it's, you know, if he's not gaining from it, if the friends aren't gaining from it, he doesn't, sorry, I was almost dropped a S-bomb, but you know where I'm going with that.
I know where
every
you're going.
Week, you know, every single week.
You know, it'd be really great if, like, we had, like, maybe an environmental lawyer who was running for office, and then he could, like, really set us straight. And he can do that on a whole variety of issues, including why vaccines are horrible and why the CIA killed his father and his uncle. Oh, wait, no, we don't want that. I'm, of course, talking about Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who is running an independent candidacy for the president of the United States in this year's election. He has a lot of people worried, and actually a lot of people on both sides. It's a both sides issue, because people from the Democratic side and President Joe Biden are worried that, you know, people may not understand Kennedy's conspiratorial anti-science stand on a number of issues. And people on the Republican side, on the Trump side, Donald Trump's popularity amongst his base takes a dip whenever he demands credit for the COVID vaccines. And that's when some of his people start looking at Robert F. Kennedy Jr. So it's a really confusing confluence of things that you have a third party candidate who may be a spoiler for either or. But I did watch an interview with Robert F. Kennedy on CNN this week. And boy, when you have somebody saying that Joe Biden might be a bigger, although he has walked that back since, Joe Biden might be a bigger threat to democracy than Donald Trump after January 6, 2021. Oh boy.
Yeah, RFK Jr. is just continuously walking back stuff. And that's it's an issue in that what the key problem here is the American system, because a third party candidate, like, he'll never win an electoral college seat, but yet he's going to be able to steer it. And that's the weird thing with this situation. There's no real draw, even though he has Democrat origins. He's essentially like a Nepo baby of the Democrats. He has the name. And yet he split from them, and I don't know if it's his entire family, but all of the siblings were like, we don't want anything to do with this guy at all. I'm sure there's some maybe random candidates that do, but his immediate people have said, just no, because they're staying with the firm. They're going to stay with the Democrats.
The firm.
They can't not. Well, you know, they're American royalty as far as
sure.
Politics goes. So why is he doing it? And some of the reasons are really strange, including, well, you know, Biden's a threat to democracy because what he did to me. And immediately after the election, I was removed from Twitter, and I was removed from this and that. And that's why you're running? It's not in your environmental record. Like, go back a few years, I'm going to say quite a few years, he was a default guy. He was on Democracy Now! A lot. Like, his opinion mattered when it came specifically to the environment. As you said, he was an environmental lawyer. And then he steered right well before COVID into the conspiracy stuff about vaccines and other things you mentioned about the CIA conspiracies and whatnot. So he derailed a little bit, let's say, when it comes to stuff like that. Put it this way, he's had a couple of one-on-ones recently with Jordan Peterson. So in my world, anybody who does that is like, they have to be sketch, right? So that's just my... I mean, I'm sure there's probably somebody been on with Jordan Peterson that I'm okay with. But when I see that, immediately it's just like, whatever. And now he has a running mate, lawyer Nicole Shanahan, who is that no one knows anything about other than she was married to the Google founder, one of the Google founders, and she has a lot of money, which is good. Deep pockets are good. You need deep pockets in American politics. But she has no experience. What did it say her job? I guess it's a self-invented job with her firm. She's the global joy officer.
Yeah.
Red flag to me. That's just red. With anybody with a title like that, like, just walk away. Just don't even pay attention, America. Take my advice from here in Guelph. But it's just like, why are you doing this? And they're allowed to, because that's democracy, right? But we know the way the system works is like, you're gonna change some things, but maybe it's going to be a wild card result because of it.
Well, he's 100% allowed to run for office. Like the guy in England who ran as Darth Vader, you know, ran for one of the seats in London, in one of the recent UK elections. That's, I mean, being a character running for office is fine.
That's Lord Buckethead, though, versus
Buckethead. Lord, send us Lord Buckethead to save us. I mean, the core problem is that he is treated like any other candidate, which maybe comes with being a Kennedy. And to your point, why is he running for office? It's the grift, and I think you see this in the United States. You just have this more and more with people who see running for president of the United States as essentially a get rich quick scheme or get famous quick scheme. Vivek Ramaswamy, like, what was his Middle East policy? What was his tax policy? I don't know, but we all know his name. Dean Phillips. Dean Phillips' whole thing is like, I'm not as old as Joe Biden, elect me. And everyone's like, no, that's okay, we're going to stick with Joe Biden. But I mean, he was the one guy who was willing to take all the black eyes from the establishment. And it was, you know, he knew he wasn't going to win. It was purely for, you know, the name ID and making a name for himself. Robert F. Kennedy Jr., as you said, he was thrown off social media because he was spreading conspiracies, because he was spreading COVID misinformation. So what do? Run for president, because but social media companies and the legacy media companies, they don't want to look political. They don't want to look biased. So we'll treat you like a normie candidate, even though, like, again, with Robert F. Kennedy, what's his Middle East policy? How's he going to handle Ukraine? How's he going to, like, restore reproductive rights? Is that something he's going to do? And how's he going to do that? Who might he appoint to the court? I mean, he was going to pick Aaron Rodgers as his running mate at one point. Is Aaron Rodgers up for a cabinet position? Mm. I mean, he could arguably do worse as a cabinet secretary than as the quarterback of the New York Jets, or perhaps do better. I don't know. I know that he played 10 minutes of football last season, so maybe he could be more productive. But yeah, I think this... He's an example of I think the ultimate problem with American politics right now is that they do not know how to tell the difference between people who seriously want to be president of the United States and people who are not that they don't know, or that rather than they don't want to make that distinction. Nobody wants to be the first person to call Trump a liar, no matter how many times he lies. We're going to give him Pinocchios till we run out. And it's the same thing. Nobody wants to treat Robert F. Kennedy Jr. like he's a grifter who's just trying to get social media attention. So, because he's a Kennedy, and we got to treat him like a Kennedy, no matter how crazy he sounds. That's a big problem.
Trump really likes him. He says he's a very smart person. Trump had him on the vaccine safety panel of all panels
Yeah.
Right. But then he's like, oh, his ideas, particularly with the environment, are far, far further left than Biden. But yet Trump's like, I love that he's running. Of course you love that he's running, because if he just siphons away just enough.
Yeah.
What was the math about, you know, Biden is ahead, but with Kennedy and the others in the mix, like Jill Stein and
Cornel West,
almost said Conrad Black. Yikes.
That's a Freudian slip and a half.
Yeah. Oh, hell no. And that totally changes the calculus. It changes things completely. So of course Trump likes him. They're like, no, don't say anything bad about Kennedy, because he may put you over the top.
He's a chaos agent. Yeah.
Yeah. Even though he criticized Ralph Nader back in 2000, wasn't that part of that CNN interview? It's like, no, she shouldn't do that because XYZ, like the exact reasons that RFK is running now, RFK Jr. is running now.
Yep. But he's got,
I mean, that's not
now.
The reasons why, but the structurally it's the same.
Yeah.
No, Ralph Nader has to wear that for the rest of time, being the spoiler of 2000. Look how that went.
No, for sure. But I mean, Ralph Nader is somebody who was like truly dedicated to the cause of like raising awareness on issues.
Oh, yeah.
Weren't getting a lot of play. Robert F. Kennedy is truly concerned about where his next, you know, $5 a plate meal is coming from. So,
well, at least he was able to get off heroin. So that'll probably help.
Good for him. Good for him. Yeah. Let's end it on a positive note for sure. Yeah, sadly, that's the end of this week's show. We hope you liked it. If you'd like to listen to it again, you can download it every Monday from our website, opensourcesguelph.com, or on the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean, or you can get us at your favorite podcast app, like Apple, TuneIn, and Spotify. You can stay connected to us on social media. We're on Facebook at Open Sources Newswire, and we're on Twitter at @OS_Guelph. I will return to CFRU Wednesday at 3 p.m. for the movie review show that I co-host called End Credits. And you can also find me on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, or check out my news and politics site at guelphpolitico.ca.
And I'm Scott Hertz on Facebook, Twitter, and Blue Sky. And if you're joining us at 5 o'clock on a Thursday, which is our regular time, please stay tuned for the volunteer playlist.
And that is one of the many great programs that you will hear on this station, CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. This very show will return next Thursday at 5 p.m. for another edition of Open Sources, and we will see you then.
Hi, this is Justin Trudeau. You're listening to CFIU 93.3 Guelph Campus Radio.